Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, 43,000 more National Guard and Reserve called up to spend a year in Iraq or Kuwait.
Howard Dean says he'll let supporters decide if he should forego public funds.
And Senator Zell Miller says he'll enthusiastically vote for President Bush, but he's no Republican.
I was born a Democrat, and I've been in this party for so long, I compare it to living in an old house. And you know if it's getting drafty and hard to heat and the commodes won't flush, but it's home.
These stories, and a presidential candidate looks for a first lady.
I would definitely want someone who was fearless in her desire for peace in the world and for universal single-payer health care and a full employment economy. If you're out there, call me.
Coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Bush is calling for democratic reforms in the Middle East. Speaking to the National Endowment for Democracy, the president said the Israeli-Palestinian conflict cannot be resolved unless Palestinians renounce terrorism and embrace democratic ideals.
Palestinian leaders who block and undermine democratic reform and feed hatred and encourage violence are not leaders at all. They are the main obstacles to peace and to the success of the Palestinian people.
The president also said democratic reforms are the key to Iraq's future. In about an hour, he'll sign the supplemental bill for Iraq and Afghanistan. The $87 billion package will fund military operations in both countries. It also includes more than $18 billion for Iraqi reconstruction. Two American soldiers have been killed in separate incidents in Iraq, and a Polish-led multinational military division has suffered its first combat death there. NPR's Ivan Watson has details.
A Polish soldier was shot in the neck today as his convoy traveled to the town of Karbala. The soldier later died of injuries at a hospital. It's the first combat death for Iraq's 10,000-man multinational division, which comprises of servicemen from 23 countries. Spokesmen for the division say much like the rest of the country, they've seen an increase in attacks against their troops since the beginning of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. Last night, a U.S. soldier was killed and two more were injured when they were ambushed south of the Iraqi capital. This morning, another American soldier was killed when a military truck hit a landmine on Iraq's western border with Syria. Despite this resistance, a Japanese diplomat says in coming months, his country will contribute hundreds of troops to the U.S.-led occupation. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Baghdad.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says he believes the economy is poised to begin creating new jobs. But in a speech to the Securities Industry Association, he warned about the dangers of increasing budget deficits. Greenspan said it's critical for Congress and the administration to address the deficits, just as previously elected officials have done.
Looking back over the past 20 years or so, it has been evident that the prospect of large deficits generally has led to actions to narrow them. I trust that the recent deterioration in the budget outlook and the fast approaching retirement of the baby boom generation will be met with similar determination and effectiveness.
Greenspan urged the government to reinstate budget rules that require any future tax increases to be offset by spending cuts or by increases in other taxes. Stocks are mixed at this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 28 points. The Nasdaq is up a point. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, the Pentagon has agreed to a compromise on its controversial $21 billion plan to lease 100 Boeing 767 jets to use as refueling tankers. Critics had said the plan was too expensive. Under the compromise, the Pentagon will lease 20 of the jets and buy the other 80. That would save about $4 billion. The compromise was hammered out by Virginia Republican John Warner, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Michigan's Carl Levin, who is the ranking Democrat. Productivity of U.S. workers soared during the just-completed quarter, increasing by 8.1%, according to the Labor Department. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
At no time in the past decade have U.S. businesses been able to see such big boosts in the productivity of their labor forces. The rise in non-farm productivity for the 3 months ending in September came even as the economy continued to lose jobs and the government-reported unit labor costs actually fell more than 4.5%. The government also revised up its second-quarter productivity numbers. The data graphically illustrates what has been an ongoing productivity revolution in the workplace. Companies, either through their use of new technologies or by simply making their existing employees work harder, have been able to raise output and keep costs in line. The strong third-quarter productivity numbers were not a surprise to economists, since data released last week showed the economy growing by its strongest rate in more than two decades. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Kohl's Department Stores is reporting weak sales in October. The company says sales at stores open at least 1 year were down 11.6% last month. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Alerts are going out now to 43,000 Reserve and National Guard troops. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announcing this midday they'll be called up for year-long tours of duty in Iraq or Kuwait. The Marine Corps has also announced it will send 20,000 active duty units back to the region. Despite the call-ups, the Pentagon says it will draw down the total number of troops in Iraq next year. Well, joining us from Washington is Jay Farrar. He's a retired colonel and a military analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome, Colonel.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Colonel, assuming Iraq remains a conflict zone for years to come, what do you make of the fact that we're calling up tens of thousands of Reserve and National Guard troops, calling up the Marines, which usually isn't done except when a war is starting? Marines usually start a war and leave, and yet the Pentagon wants to have less troops in Iraq next year.
Well, there's a couple of things going on. Number one, they believe they'll be able to have fewer overall numbers of U.S. forces in Iraq because they will be augmented by newly trained Iraqi policemen and paramilitary forces. Second of all, the plan is to replace typical combat troops, infantry, tankers, artillery units, with military people who have more specialties that align to this situation, military police, civil reconstruction, so on and so forth, and also potentially to put in National Guard forces as well, who have had an opportunity to gain a little more training in dealing with a paramilitary-type situation, which is where Iraq really is now.
Colonel, what do you make of? We keep hearing, it seems to me, even from military brass, that they don't have enough soldiers to do what they need to do in Iraq.
Well, listen, the one thing you always have to be aware of is any military commander would like to have more forces than he has, and that's to take strain off the forces who are engaged.
And if conflict broke out, God forbid, as we say, in Korea or Colombia or anywhere else, we'd have enough combat troops to deal with a second or even a third front.
I believe so, mainly because you have to look at what types of conflicts are most likely to occur. And the Pentagon obviously believes that the types of conflicts most likely to occur can be handled with the current troop strengths we have now.
Just to finish up, Colonel, you were a soldier for a long time. How much strain does it put on a young soldier, let alone a soldier who may have been, working at a Home Depot a couple months before his National Guard unit was called up to do a year-long tour of duty in a place where there's a low-intensity guerrilla war kind of hammering away at them psychologically, not to mention risking their lives day after day?
Well, I'd be kidding you to say there is no stress or strain for anybody. You know, I I did 23 years in the Marine Corps and was deployed a few times. And there is strain. You have to try to put that in perspective. The biggest problem in these situations, most likely here as well, is the irregular nature of what's happening, the fact that you're away from home, and you'd like to have a determined endpoint to your being there so that you can plan things. It does a tremendous amount of psychological damage when you don't know when your tour is going to end, and that has affected a lot of the folks in country now. The best thing the military has done is to put a set time frame on when forces are going to come in and when they're going to be allowed to go home.
Colonel Jay Farrar is a military analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much for joining us, Colonel.
You're welcome.
Howard Dean may soon become the first Democrat to reject public financing of a presidential campaign since that system was instituted in the Watergate era. Dean says he'll let his supporters make the decision by voting, in part online. The results are expected by Saturday. The Internet vaulted Dean from obscure candidate to frontrunner, and he argues he can continue to make money there to be the best candidate to compete with the fundraising of President Bush. Well, joining us on the line from New Hampshire is Linda Fowler. She's professor of government at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Welcome, Professor Fowler.
Hello.
And remind us, why would Dean feel he'd be at a disadvantage if he took public financing? Remind us how it works.
Well, public financing is available for all primary candidates. And given the crowded field, most of the candidates will probably spend all of the public money that they obtain by the end of March when the primaries are expected to be mostly over.
But in return, they have to promise to what?
They can spend no more than the public money. And the problem for any Democrat is that when the public money runs out, which is probably March, there's a long time between March and the Democratic convention at the end of July when they won't be able to raise any money or spend any.
And President Bush has set fundraising records in the primary season.
That's right. And he's scheduled ads beginning to run in January. I understand it's over $100 million worth of ads that have been booked. And so any Democrat who wins a nomination is in effect going to be naked in terms of a national campaign or national advertising from the end of March until the end of July.
Mm.
The irony is that the reason why Dean is in a position to even think about giving up public funding is that he's created a small donor base through the Internet. This is not something that Democrats have been very good at. Historically, they've been much more dependent for soft money from large donors, which is now banned under McCain-Feingold, and they've relied heavily on large contributions from labor unions.
Mm.
So the irony is that Dean, in being able to give up public funding, is doing so because he's created a large base of small donors.
Which was something campaign finance advocates wanted.
That's correct.
So that is ironic.
And so the two things are really problematic. The Democrats always felt that campaign finance was an issue that they had to support on kind of ideological grounds and because they're supposed to be the party of the ordinary working person. At the same time, the rules have never really worked very well for them. And with this new playing field of McCain-Feingold, they have to find a different way to operate. And Dean has found that way. And ironically, now they're trying to make him look like some kind of a bad guy, when in fact he's done what the party needed to be doing.
If he drops out of public financing, is that a nail in the coffin of public financing?
Well, no, because in the end, the public finance piece of the campaign finance laws were becoming more problematic because the public has stopped doing the checkoff system, and there really isn't enough money anymore in the public finance system to really cover the cost of a modern campaign, particularly when the president is able to raise huge amounts of money and be outside the system itself. So I think you could probably say the nail was driven in the coffin in the 2000 election when Bush opted out of it.
Mm. The checkoff system, by the way, where you can donate part of your tax proceeds to public financing.
Yeah, I think it's $3.
So the public participated in this as well.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, Professor, thank you.
Okay.
Linda Fowler, Professor of Government and Director of Rockefeller Center for Social Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Well, campaign finance reform was not on the agenda at a candidates' forum in New Hampshire last night, but family leave, international women's rights, and daycare were. Six of the Democratic candidates attended the forum, sponsored in part by Planned Parenthood of New Hampshire. And Robin, you joined syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman and New Hampshire Public Radio's Laura Kinoy in posing questions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, President Bush signed into law yesterday the late-term abortion ban, and a Nebraska judge issued an injunction against the law just as the forum began. I'm imagining that was a hot topic.
You know, it was, although I was disappointed that more of the candidates didn't address the disconnect between their stand against the ban and the majority of Americans who support it. I'm not sure many Americans or most Americans know the ban does not contain an exception for the health of the woman. But this was a very pro-choice crowd, and the candidates, including John Kerry, played this issue as a move towards ending choice.
This president has exploited this issue. There's nothing partial, may I say, about their effort to undo Roe v. Wade. And I am the only candidate here who has said declaratively, I will appoint no person to the Supreme Court of the United States whose philosophy is to undo Roe v. Wade. They call it a litmus test. I call it protecting constitutional rights in America.
And Bill, on another question about reproductive rights, General Wesley Clark said he opposed the ban on abortions for female soldiers at military hospitals and that he would change that.
Well, you know, Robin, earlier this week at that Rock the Vote forum, a couple of candidates got rather hot under the collar. There were some heated exchanges. How about last night?
Well, in fact, there was a makeup last night of sorts. Senator John Edwards of North Carolina said he accepted Howard Dean's apology, you know, for using the Confederate flag phrase. There were interesting exchanges. We'd asked the candidates, how far would you go to protect women's rights in countries with U.S. relations. I asked Governor Dean, how far would you go? Would you impose sanctions against Saudi Arabia, for instance, for its treatment of women? Here's what he said, followed by Senator Kerry's response.
I think Saudi Arabia ought to be sanctioned for a lot more than that. How about the funding of teaching of small children to hate America in the entire Islamic world? That's a pretty good reason to sanction Saudi Arabia without even getting into women's rights.
Well, before you shoot from the hip and go off sanctioning Saudi Arabia, while there is a great deal for us to engage with in Saudi Arabia, it would be a good idea, since they have 46% of the world's oil and we import 60% of it, to know what the alternative for our economy is going to be.
Senator Kennedy and Governor Dean at last night's forum on women's issues. Robin, what was the general tone last night?
Well, let's see. How about Love Fest?
Okay.
You know, there were moments that didn't resonate with the crowd. I'm thinking of when General Wesley Clark said he'd support the death penalty if only the truly guilty, for instance, Osama bin Laden, were executed. That didn't go over well. Dean said he didn't approve of parental notification if a minor was seeking an abortion. Afterwards, he told me that's a rare case, but he had a patient once, you know, he was a doctor in Vermont, a pregnant 12-year-old. He was convinced her father was the child's father, the unborn baby's father. He didn't do abortions, but he felt to notify her father would endanger her life. I think that's going to be a topic that will be revisited. Ambassador Mosley Braun said that 18-year-old girls shouldn't have to register for the military as boys do because military academies aren't safe for girls. But in all, they agreed on many of the issues having to do with women. The candidates were loose. They were very human at several points, including when they were asked who their first person would be. Mosley Braun, a single mom, said, "You just get me, you get nothing free." Senator Edwards, he lost a child. He was very emotional, speaking of his stay-at-home wife. But Dennis Kucinich got the biggest laugh of the night.
Thank you. As a bachelor, I get a chance to fantasize about my first lady. And you know, I mean, maybe Fox wants to sponsor a national contest or something. I would definitely want someone who was fearless in her desire for peace in the world and for universal single-payer health care and a full employment economy. If you're out there, call me.
This is the first presidential personal advertisement in history.
On the lighter side, Dennis Kucinich last night, one of the candidates at last night's forum on women's issues. Robin was there, and thanks, Robin.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, just ahead, Senator Zell Miller of Georgia, a lifelong Democrat who's voting Republican next time.
And later in the program, pictures from China's Cultural Revolution, hidden from Mao's view during the 60s, now in a new book.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The southern states will be a crucial battleground in the next presidential election. Last time around, George Bush swept the South, including, of course, controversially, Florida. Well, Senator Zell Miller of Georgia thinks the president will win the South again, and he hopes he does, though Senator Miller is a lifelong Democrat. The senator explains his passionate support for President Bush and his disgust with his own party in his new book, A National Party No More, The Conscience of a Conservative Democrat. Zell Miller now joins us. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us, Senator. Let's start with the issue of the week. What do you think of Howard Dean's calls for Democrats to win over guys with Confederate flag decals in their trucks, and his plea also this week for Southerners not to base their votes on race, guns, God, and gays, he said? Your reaction?
Well, this is the thrust of some of my book. That is that these national candidates right now who are running for president simply do not understand the South. They think it's some strange, dark continent. They don't know about the modern South. The modern South is not that South of KKK leaders and somebody hunting somebody to lynch and mint juleps and magnolia trees. The South today is a very vibrant place with a lot of Fortune 500 headquarters located there, 5,500 African Americans elected to office, many of them statewide. Minority students finish high school at the same rate as others.
Yeah, but Senator, are Democrats that clueless about the South? I mean, a certain Al Gore did win 44% of voters in 2000 in your own state of Georgia. It's not bad.
No, but I think it takes over 50% to carry Georgia. And the thing about it is you can get a certain percentage. You can put together the liberals. You can put together the block vote, and you could come up with maybe 40 to 45% in some of these states. But if you look at the history of the South over the last 10 election cycles, four times they haven't managed to carry a single state. Twice they've only managed to carry one state. When they have been able to carry a few states, like Clinton did in 92 and 96, and like Jimmy Carter did back in 76, they have won.
So what should Democrats do, Senator? What's your prescription?
Well, what they ought to do is they ought to look at how successful Democrats were. I mean, and the best example is your own John Kennedy. John Kennedy carried the state of Georgia by a larger percentage than he carried the state of Massachusetts.
What was his secret?
His secret was he was strong on national defense. He beat up on Richard Nixon on that and came across as stronger in the debates. He also was a tax cutter. And when he was elected, he cut taxes really in a larger way than President Bush has cut taxes. And they benefited the rich even more. But he knew this was the investment class. He knew this was the group that created jobs. He could have been reelected in the South had he lived.
Well, Senator, you're a passionate supporter of President Bush and virtually all of the Republican agenda, as far as I can tell. Why aren't you a Republican?
Well, because I'm 72 years old and I was born a Democrat and I've been in this party for so long, I know it's hard to understand, I compare it to living in an old house. And you know if it's getting drafty and hard to heat and the commodes won't flush and last week some strangers moved into the basement and you don't know who they are or how to get them out. But it's home. It's where I've always been. And at my age, I haven't got long to live here. So I'm not going to let them run me out. This is my home, always has been and always will be, and I know that's hard for anybody to understand, but it makes sense to me, and it makes sense to my family, and it makes sense to my neighbors, and at my age, that's all that matters.
Well, fair enough. You are a son of the Georgia Mountains. You have a real sense for average people. You support tax cuts for average people, Senator, but does it concern you that many economists, and not just liberal economists by any means, are very concerned that in 10 years or so, there's going to be what they call a fiscal gap? The government simply will not have taken in enough money over 10 years or so to pay for things like Social Security and Medicare. And when baby boomers hit in 10 years, there won't be enough money for their benefits.
So. Well, you cut and save in other ways. This deficit is not because of tax cuts. It's because of big spending.
The deficit is monumental. It's nearly $400 billion.
Well, you couldn't do it immediately, but you could do it over a period of time.
How do you do it with big tax cuts?
You cut spending.
Yeah, but, Senator, the vast amount of spending is on defense and entitlement programs. There's really not that much in the budget beyond that to cut, is there, for the kind of numbers we're talking about?
You're going to say this doesn't amount to much, but have you ever looked at the bloated payrolls of Congress? Have you ever looked at the bloated payrolls of some of these federal agencies? There's a lot of room to cut out there. There's a lot of waste in federal government. I've been appalled at it since I came to Washington.
$400 billion worth of waste in a given year?
Not in one given year, but if you get at it a little bit at a time, and with the economy coming back the way that the economy is going to come back, it would be there. Look, you're not going to have anybody talking about it's the economy, stupid, in 2004. I guarantee you.
Democrats have any chance of winning the South in 2004 and any chance of taking the White House if they don't?
Well, not. It's going to be very difficult because you can't run on the worst feature of the McGovern campaign, cut and run, and peace at any price, and the worst feature of the Mondale campaign, hold on to your wallet, we're going to raise your taxes. Those are two features that will cause disaster for the Democratic Party. They need to be running on what Clinton ran on in 92 and 96, or what Kennedy ran on in 1960.
Any other contenders running at the moment asking for your advice?
I don't think they'll be asking for it much anymore after this book. I'm trying to throw them a life preserver. If they don't want to grab hold of the life preserver and want to swim off in the other direction, then they can go to it.
Well, Senator Miller, just to finish up, I think you've tried to retire before, right? But then you got kind of lassoed into running for Senate, and now you're going to retire again. What are you going to do?
I'm going back home to those mountains where I came from, and I'm going to enjoy being around my children and grandchildren. I have four great-grandchildren and probably teach a little history like I used to at this little college in my hometown.
Georgia Senator Zell Miller is author of the new book, A National Party No More, The Conscience of a Conservative Democrat. Senator Zell Miller, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, CBS bows to pressure and pulls a miniseries about the Reagans.
And we'll review a new documentary on the late hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur, produced by his mother, much of it told in the artist's own words.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, fueled by the California forest fires, the Senate okays a bill that thins forests on public lands across the West.
The fact is that if you have 10 or 15 or 20 trees an acre versus 200 or 1,000 trees an acre, one is a beautiful forest that you can walk through. The other's a fire hazard.
And images a Chinese photographer risked his life for to record the Chinese Cultural Revolution.
He is somebody who wants to use what he recorded to explain to people how terrible things were and how things went wrong.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Pentagon officials now acknowledge a defense advisor received a secret message that Saddam Hussein wanted to make a deal just days before the invasion of Iraq. The New York Times and ABC News say Iraq offered to let U.S. troops and experts into the country to verify that Iraq no longer had any weapons of mass destruction. U.S. officials rejected the offer, saying Iraq had been given years of opportunities to avoid war. A White House spokesman this morning downplayed the offer and refused to say whether it was brought to President Bush's attention. Two more American soldiers have been killed in Iraq. One was near the Syrian border when his truck hit a landmine this morning. The other died when his patrol came under fire near Baghdad last night. And Poland has suffered its first combat death in Iraq. A Polish major died after an ambush of his convoy just south of Baghdad. Two people were confirmed dead in a shooting at an Ohio trucking company today. Authorities say that a total of five people were shot at the company in a Cincinnati suburb. Police say the shooter, who was carrying two handguns, opened fire at the facility and then fled. It is not clear if the man knew the victims. In a setback for the Bush administration, a U.N. committee today delayed for 2 years a U.S.-led drive for a broad global ban on all forms of human cloning, including medical research on stem cells. By a razor-thin margin of 80 to 79 with 15 abstentions, the U.N. General Assembly's legal committee adopted a motion to defer drafting the treaty until 2005. The motion was put forward by Iran on behalf of 57 Islamic nations. There's a big merger in the works in the music industry today in Germany. Bertelsmann AG and Sony announced that they've signed a non-binding letter of intent to merge their music businesses. The merger would bring together the number two and number five music companies in the world as the industry struggles with losses that are blamed on music piracy. Bobby Hatfield of the Righteous Brothers has died. His body was discovered in bed last night at his hotel room in Kalamazoo, Michigan, 30 minutes before he was scheduled to perform. There's no word yet on the cause of death. Bobby Hatfield was 63 years old. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 33 points. The Nasdaq is down a fraction. The S&P 500 is down 2. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In a move which is being viewed as a major victory for utility companies and a blow to environmentalists, the Environmental Protection Agency will drop investigations into whether more than 50 power plants violated federal clean air laws. According to government lawyers, new rules implemented in August by the EPA are less stringent and have made it more difficult to investigate alleged clean air violations. The New York Times says the rule change grew out of Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force, which 2 years ago raised concerns about the EPA's enforcement actions.
Well, while the EPA relaxes rules for power plants, the Senate voted last week for leaner forests. Fueled by the destruction caused by forest fires in Southern California, the Senate overwhelmingly approved President Bush's Healthy Forests Initiative, which calls for thinning forests on millions of acres of public lands across the West. Environmentalists say the Senate bill and a similar one already passed by the House are a boon to the timber industry. We're joined now by Mitzi Emmerich of the Sierra Club. Welcome, Mitzi.
Hi.
Mitzi, fires throughout the West in recent years have been fueled by trees too close to residential areas, often untrimmed for years because people like to live among trees. How aggressively do these bills address that problem?
Well, actually, that's the problem, is that the Senate and House bills, and basically these are in support of the president's Healthy Forest Initiative, don't really address what the problem is, and that's people building their homes out into this urban wildland interface where we have a lot of trees, and it's not doing anything to help homes and communities protect themselves. It's not helping people, you know, with funding to go out and trim back trees from their roofs and clean out their yard and their gutters and plant fire-resistant trees and plants. Instead, it's focused on logging, you know, out in the backcountry, sometimes hundreds of miles away from the nearest home and community, and it really does nothing to stop the immediate problem, which is the loss of homes and communities.
Now, wait a minute. I understood that the Senate bill, anyway, did require about half the clearing to be done around populated areas.
That's correct. It required half, not much at all, you know, only 50%. And the 50% that is required to be directed at protecting homes and communities isn't actually a priority that that work be done first. And also the language of that portion of the bill is so ambiguous. And actually, it's left up to the Secretary of Agriculture. She can redirect those funds at any point. So it's in no way a guarantee that people are going to get money to protect their homes and communities at all.
So is it the Sierra Club's position that all the attention should have been to trees in residential areas and hardly any of it to trees deeper in the forest?
Correct. It's our position and the position of the environmental community and of firefighters and of local governments that the money needs to be focused at fuel reduction around homes and communities.
Now, you're saying that the Senate bill, anyway, is only 50% in residential areas. What do you think the Senate's up to, then, if it wants 50% of the cutting done much deeper in the forest?
Well, actually, Speaker of the House Denny Hastert boasted recently that the Healthy Forest Initiative, and this is a direct quote, is an important bill for the forest industry. And I think that really illustrates the underlying goal of the administration, and that's to go out and help the timber industry get into these areas that have been off limits for several years and let them go back in and log. And really, if you think about it logically, if the goal of the administration was to let the timber industry go in and protect homes and communities, what would the timber industry gain from that? You know, what needs to be cleared from around homes and communities is brush and dry, dead, flammable material. That's not stuff that has any kind of commercial economic value. So there's really no incentive for the industry to do that. What the timber industry wants to do is take out heavy, commercially, you know, expensive timber that they can sell. And that's actually the stuff that doesn't catch on fire, the stuff that's survived, you know, hundreds of fires over their lifetime. These trees have seen numerous fires. And those are the things that the industry wants to go in and cut down.
Mitzi Emmerich of the Sierra Club joined us from Washington. Mitzi, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We turn now to Bill Kovacs, Vice President for Environmental Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a supporter of President Bush's Healthy Forest Initiative that's now passed both the House and Senate. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Bill, you just heard Mitzi Emmerich of the Sierra Club say there's not nearly enough emphasis in the president's Healthy Forest Initiative and in the bills now passed by the Senate and House on trimming woods simply near residential communities. Your thoughts?
The president is really on the right track, and so is the Congress. What they're trying to do is go back to where Teddy Roosevelt was and Gifford Pinchuk, who was the head of the Forest Service, and they viewed forest as a multi-use undertaking. The communities live within forest. They logged within forests, houses were in forests, factories were in forests. And what they're trying to do is to balance what it is we're trying to do across the environmental spectrum, and that is they're putting half of the money into the urban wildlife interface so that we can protect those areas. But they're also addressing the serious problem with which the environmentalists have caused, which is to put forests off limits, to let them build up with brush and leaves and bacteria. And these things become fuel sources for a fire.
So you're saying the deep forest is also a cause of the fires that have so devastated so many parts of the West. It's not just a problem of woods around residential areas.
Certainly it is, because it's the deep underbrush. And when lightning strikes, or unfortunately a campfire is there, or something happens and all of a sudden it starts into a flame, they can't be contained because of the amount of fuel. So not to balance how you would spend the money, half in the forest and the deep forest and half in the urban interface would really be a reckless policy that doesn't recognize the fact that the federal government owns most of the land in the West, and they have to protect it all. They can't just worry about one part of it.
Bill, what do you make of House Majority Leader Denny Hastert saying this is an important bill for the forest industry?
I think Hastert's absolutely right that it is an important bill, because people live here too. It's not just the forest for backpackers. And so that if we're going to do something, we ought to recognize what we started in 1912 when we started the Forest Service, and what's wrong with allowing timber companies to go in and take out dead brush or to thin it out. The fact is that if you have 10 or 15 or 20 trees an acre versus 200 or 1,000 trees an acre, one is a beautiful forest that you can walk through. The other's a fire hazard. And I think it's got to help the communities, but it's also there's nothing wrong with helping business and bringing jobs to the United States.
Should the logging industry be cutting down old growth trees?
I don't think that that's what this says. In fact, one of the things that this does do for the first time is there are provisions designed to protect the old growth strands, and that's an important provision of the bill that was put in by the Senate.
Bill, when do you expect a bill?
We would hope as soon as possible, especially in light of the California fires, and Congress has 2 or 3 weeks left, and I think that it's going to be a fairly simple conference, and we're going to get a bill. We might get it as soon as middle of November.
Bill Kovacs is Vice President for Environmental Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Thanks a lot for joining us,
Bill. Thanks very much. Bye.
Still to come, photographs from China's Cultural Revolution, taken by an official government photographer who hid the negatives for years.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It could be seen as a defeat for the United States at the United Nations today. Instead of passing a U.S.-backed resolution to immediately ban all forms of human cloning, the U.N. voted instead to study the issue first. Reporter Linda Fasulo is at the United Nations. And Linda, the United States and other countries had hoped to have this total ban on human cloning. The other side of the debate wanted to allow certain cloning?
Exactly. The United States and its allies, led by Costa Rica, which was co-sponsoring the resolution that would call for a total ban on all forms of cloning, they were hoping for the total ban, which obviously there was some opposition to. And on the other side were mainly Europeans and the Japanese and China, who wanted a partial ban, meaning that all cloning of human beings would be banned, but that it would be left to the individual states to determine whether or not they would allow therapeutic cloning for medical purposes.
In other words, the ban would be on producing an actual baby.
Exactly.
And in therapeutic cloning, stem cells are harvested from the cloned embryos for the research. The embryos are then discarded, which some oppose on religious grounds. They see that as ending a potential life.
Exactly. And it was very interesting, because what I heard was, what did happen in the legal committee today at the UN was that the Iranians, backed by the 57-member organization of the Islamic Conference, proposed this motion to basically defer the whole cloning issue for 2 years so that countries would have time to reach a consensus, because there really is not a coherent view in terms of reconciling religious and, you know, political views on this issue. My understanding is that in the Islamic world, Islamic friends of mine have told me that, you know, there are differences in terms of when, you know, human life begins. You know, obviously it's an issue they're not ready to deal with at this point.
And, of course, I'm assuming that the U.S. and the allies responded that this would be 2 years of producing cloned embryos.
Exactly. But you also have to remember that even if the U.S., resolution had been pressed to a vote today and won, what it would do was would be that a working group would be formed to begin drafting a treaty that would ban human cloning. So in any case, even if they won today, it's not as if a ban would be in effect today.
And briefly, Linda, in the few seconds we have, what does this UN resolution now mean? Is it binding? Does everyone have to abide by it?
Well, it just basically means it was a motion, and it means that the General Assembly is not going to consider this issue for 2 years. So that basically we have the status quo on the, you know, worldwide at the moment for the next 2 years until 2005.
Well, the debate broadens.
Exactly.
Well, Linda, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Linda Fasulo covers the United Nations for us. She's reported on the UN vote today to study the idea of banning human cloning. Linda spoke to us from New York.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now, and it's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Many listeners agreed with health columnist Judy Foreman's point that the fear of addiction to pain drugs often prevents patients from getting adequate treatment for pain. But Sarah Cox of Lee, New Hampshire, sounded this cautionary note. As someone who was prescribed OxyContin following surgery, I made the mistake of trying to stop taking the pills a few weeks before the scheduled weaning off period. Suddenly, I was experiencing severe drug withdrawal symptoms. Thankfully, I was able to go back on the pills and successfully taper off. But it felt pretty silly to be taking a drug simply to prevent being sick from not taking the drug.
Following several segments where we talked to economists about a jobless recovery, Clarence Ellis of Charlotte, North Carolina, was moved to call our listener line.
I'd like to kind of urge your economists and commentators to consider that. A jobless recovery is about as realistic as an economic boom as we had in the 90s without profits by many of the dot-com companies. It's just a fantasy that figures that someone's putting up for their own benefit, perhaps a short-term gain, but certainly nothing is going to help the economy in the long run. Only job growth and expansion will do so, I believe.
Elizabeth Edwards wrote, responding to our segment, on how the Federal Communications Commission was proposing fining AT&T for violating do-not-call lists. I just wanted in the record that AT&T called me, too, this week. Do I tell someone? And if so, how do I contact someone for the abuse? Well, Elizabeth, we asked, and the FCC said that to file a complaint, call 1-888-CALL-FCC.
And finally, in our segment with music critic Ellen Pfeiffer on the Milken Archive compilation of Jewish music in America, Ellen referred to a shofar as a Yiddish instrument. Well, Leonard Berkowitz of Sharon, Massachusetts, greatly enjoyed the piece, but writes, "A shofar is not a Yiddish instrument, rather the horn of a ram. It is sounded during the services on Rosh Hashanah and at the conclusion of the day of Yom Kippur."
And Peter Skolnick called our listener line to complain that Ellen used the word propaganda to describe Kurt Weill's exquisite Jewish pageants, We Will Never Die and A Flag Is Born. Here's what the Milken Archive, though, has to say in the liner notes regarding these two pieces. Those have legitimately been called propagandist pageants, not with any negative connotation, but simply because their intended purpose was to rouse and persuade the public for causes.
Well, one of those causes, promoting awareness of the ongoing Holocaust. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live. For the 10 years of China's brutal Cultural Revolution, from 1966 to 1976, photographer Li Zhensheng repeatedly risked execution. He worked for the Communist Party newspaper in a city in northern China. Thousands of his beautifully composed and printed black and white pictures were published because officials wanted them to be. But he hid thousands of other negatives in a hole in his floor. Images that would have gotten him shot had they been discovered. Li Zhensheng was called a red-color news soldier, and that's the name of the first collection of his photographs. Robert Pledge edited the book, and he says although Li Zhensheng had incredible access to mass rallies and kangaroo courts and executions, he was not a member of the Communist Party.
He actually did apply several times, but he was always turned down as being somebody too independent, too rebellious, too eccentric, and not very disciplined.
I'm looking at a photograph. It's a picture of a man having his hair torn out. He's Li Fan Wu, a Communist Party leader in Harbin, where the photographs were primarily taken, bowing down, humiliated, a sign around his neck, a big looming picture of Mao Zedong behind him. Now, that's a picture that could have been published in the official newspaper in Harbin or not? Would this have been one of the negatives he hid in his floor?
Absolutely. This image and images like these of the violent public gatherings, this man, Li Fan Wu, was actually the governor, the most important man in political terms in the province. And his hairstyle was very similar to that of Mao Zedong, and the Red Guards denounced him for being very, very ambitious and expressing his ambition by adopting Mao's hairstyle, which was an indication of something rather terrible. Hmm. And most photographers actually didn't even bother to take such pictures because they knew they would not be published. And they were afraid also that if they did take the pictures and were seen taking the pictures, problems could occur for them and it could damage their careers.
Let alone pictures like on the outskirts of Harbin. It was April 1968 and a group is being led away to be executed, and hundreds of people watching this execution.
Yes, executions were public. And, of course, you know, it's very strange because, on the one hand, the party, the state, were using the photographers and the journalists to promote their ideas and, of course, their views of the revolution. So on the one hand, there was a flow of information that was very, very wide. But any time there was an event like this one that could be attended by the public, the images would not be shown, either on television, which there was very little of at that time, and certainly not in the newspapers.
These are pictures that could have gotten Li Zhenxuan himself executed. What gave him the courage, do you think? What gave him the drive and the ambition to take a chance and hide these thousands of negatives?
He realized that this event was so tremendous, that it was transforming Chinese society. He realized that probably better than most of his colleagues, and he was concerned about recording and preserving the record. It became a mission, and it is today. I mean, he is very concerned about the book being published in China one day, the exhibition that was made from the book being shown in China. I think he is, beyond being a journalist, a photographer, photojournalist, he is a historian. He is somebody who wants to use what he recorded to explain to people how terrible things were and how things went wrong.
What is Li Zhenxuan doing now, and how have these photographs, I understand some of them have been seen in China, how have they been received in China?
Well, there were a few of them, about 20 of them were shown in 1988, which was an extraordinary year in China when everything seemed possible. On that occasion, he was invited to participate in a collective show on the occasion of the upcoming 40th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And they had tremendous impact when they were seen for the very first time. I met him a few months after this exhibition took place, and he told me about the existence of this collection that he had gathered and preserved so carefully for so long, and we decided then and there that we'd work together and do a book and an exhibition, which, of course, because of the events of 1989 on Tiananmen Square, the project was postponed until 10 years later. He is right now in Beijing. He's right now actually in a hospital bed. He just was operated on for cancer. But he's confident he's going to make it. He's 63 years old. He's young. And he is a fighter.
Robert Pledge, thank you so much.
No, I thank you.
Robert Pledge is editor of Red Color News Soldier, a collection of photographs of the Cultural Revolution by Chinese photographer Li Zhenxuan. To see some of the photographs, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now.
CBS pulls a miniseries about the Reagan presidency.
And we review a new documentary on the late hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur, produced by his mother, much of it told in the artist's own words.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.